Welcome to a special edition of the Good Beer Hunting Podcast, a series of episodes devoted to one of the world's most iconic brands, from Dublin to the United States to Nigeria and the Caribbean. That beer is Guinness. Guinness became an underwriter of Good Beer Hunting about 18 months ago, helping us bring you a series of stories called Coming to America, exploring the relationship between imports and the U.S. beer drinker in the age of local craft. And more recently, they helped us start up a new series called Mother of Invention, where we explore the technical innovations, past and present, that have transformed the beer in your glass in surprising ways. And now we're taking the opportunity to explore the story of Guinness itself in a unique way for Good Beer Hunting. Guinness made it possible for us to visit historic St. James Gate in Dublin, and their new brewery in Baltimore County in the U.S., and gave us free rein to pull at the strings of the stories we've so often heard only in the form of legend. But rarely have we had the firsthand experience to dive into them. We wanted to turn legends into learning. They also gave us free rein of their brewing sites, both in Baltimore, home to their new brewery and taproom called the Open Gate Brewery, which shares a name with the public-facing Innovation Brewing taproom located in Dublin at historic St. James Gate, which, to be honest, took some real doing. It's not a place open to tourists, at least beyond the visitor center, and much of the more historical aspects are either in complete disrepair or preserved, and gaining access to those people and places isn't easy for a film and audio crew. So for all the rigmarole we caused with our persistence, we're thankful and grateful we were able to get past the gates and into some of the more fascinating aspects of the various Guinness operations. All in pursuit of understanding one big thing. What makes Guinness, Guinness? And how has that changed, or not, over all these years? Of course, along the way, we discovered dozens of things we did not anticipate. Processes and techniques, brewhouse logistics, cultural elements, historical side roads, and lots of other small things and big people that all add up to a perspective on Guinness as I see it in the year 2019. With all my inherent contemporary biases and assumptions, some of which are confirmed, and some of which fall apart like the beauty of a nitro charge releasing into a pint of the black stuff. Which, for example, they'll tell you is actually ruby red. Well, depending on where you're from, the experience of Guinness may vary wildly, even if it tastes largely the same. The Guinness of 2019 may seem like an unbelievably preserved gem of brewing history. It's still drank in some of the same pubs in Dublin that it has been for hundreds of years. And similarly, in the U.S., albeit on a much younger timeline, in pubs that value their connections to their homeland as much as they do their surrounding neighborhoods. But it's not some amber-preserved relic brought back to life in a new age. In fact, Guinness in 2019 is defined as much by its rapid evolution as it is its historical integrity. And the first thing we need to do there is disambiguate between Guinness, the beer, and Guinness, the brewery. Because while the name certainly brings to mind the draft pint of nitrogenated stout that's ubiquitous in the world today, that wasn't always the case, and won't always be, either. In this series of episodes, we're going to focus on a few specific narratives that I think do the Guinness story justice, and bring it to life for today's drinker. And to do that, we're going to look at where Guinness intersects with technical innovation, its historic place in Dublin, and now Baltimore, where it opened its first purpose-built brewery in the U.S. in 2018, which is actually its second effort to run a brewery here. If you didn't know, I didn't, and how the people of Guinness past and present, including some of its most historic pub operators, have adapted over time, and how its most recent hires, like its American craft brewers in Baltimore, see their place in the next chapter of the company and brand. But to understand Guinness in 2019, we have to take a pretty big step back. Back to when its world-famous St. James Gate, located in Dublin, was already a bustling brewing district, even before Arthur Guinness arrived. An area cut through with canals and busy roads that delivered the Irish barley, hops, and other materials like wooden casks used by brewers and distillers in the area. It was 1759, and Arthur Guinness was here to make a deal for a brewery.
So we're here at St. James's Gate. We're here in the very oldest part of the brewery here, the Guinness Brewery. Started in 1759, and where we are right now is actually the 4-acre brewery, the original 4-acre brewery where Arthur Guinness signed a 9,000-year lease in 1759 and marks the place where the Guinness story started.
That's Fergus Brady, and you're going to be hearing a lot from him. He's the Guinness archivist, one of two archivists we'll meet on this trip, and he's basically a walking, talking encyclopedia of Guinness's history. And that lease he's talking about? It's part of the legend of the brewery, a factoid that people share at parties and debate the validity of for their own entertainment. And listener, it's real. I saw the lease with my own eyes. But here's the interesting part. The lease is for about 4 acres, which at the time would have been a sizable chunk of real estate for a startup brewery. But by 1838, it would be the largest brewery in Ireland, and by 1886, the largest brewery in the world. So it's safe to say that the portion listed in the lease, St. James Gate, those 4 acres, is more like a seed planted in what is now a very large field that is the modern Guinness Brewery. Over time, Guinness's St. James Gate consumed most of the breweries and distilleries around it as it grew. And then there's the matter of what state the brewery was in when Arthur took it over.
What we do have attached to the lease is we have a schedule. So if you're familiar with the concept of renting anywhere, you always get a schedule that tells you what exactly is included in the lease. And this is the contents of the schedule for the lease that Arthur signed in 1759. So it gives you some idea as to the condition of the brewery when Arthur took it on in 1759. So can I just, just so I can see myself.
That's Jessica Handy, a fellow archivist for Guinness, and she's walking me through a host of original materials in the archives. Brewing logs, old advertisements, family photos, and of course, the physical copy of the lease.
So for example, it tells you here that there's one keeve very bad. It tells you that you've got one underback quite decayed. So even though there was brewery equipment on the premises already, it was in quite bad condition. So Arthur was really starting from scratch when he came here at St. James's Gate.
Despite the importance of St. James Gate and the establishing of his family tree, the story of Guinness doesn't start at St. James Gate at all. Like most brewers, Arthur got his start on a smaller system working for somebody else until he got the itch to break out and start his own.
Arthur Guinness was born in 1725 in Selbridge in County Kildare, about a half an hour outside of Dublin. So Arthur would have got his early introduction to brewing through his father. So his father was actually a land steward on the estate of the Archbishop of Cashel, Dr. Arthur Price. One of his duties as land steward would have been to oversee the brewing of the ale on the estate. So brewing would have been a huge cottage industry at this time. A lot of estates would have brewed their own beers. So it's quite likely that that's where Arthur got his first introduction to the craft of brewing and the skills necessary to create a good and a consistent brew. A lot of people associate Arthur Guinness and Guinness with St. James's Gate here, but it actually wasn't Arthur's first brewery. His first brewery was in Leixlip, not far from where he grew up in Selbridge. So he established a brewery there in 1756, and he brewed there alongside his brother for a few years before he decided to up sticks and broaden his horizons in Dublin. So the Brewers Guild would have been the professional association for brewers at the time in the city. To give you an idea of the brewing landscape in Ireland at that time, in the 1760s, 1770s, there would have been about 300 breweries across the island of Ireland. 70 of those would have been in Dublin, and a further 20 of those were actually here in the vicinity of St. James's Gate along the banks of the River Liffey. So this particular entry is from Thursday, the 29th of January, 1767. And even though it looks inconspicuous, what's notable about this is one particular sentence. And it says, Arthur Guinness was sworn master of this corporation for the ensuing year. So this is in 1767. This is only 8 years after he established the brewery at St. James's Gate. What this tells us is that he'd reached the highest position amongst the professional community of brewers in Dublin at the time. So he was being recognised for his brewing credentials, not just by his peers, but also by his competitors. A lot of the brewers that were countersigning in this book, on this particular entry, you had Thwaites, you had Jackson. All of these would have been, established breweries in Dublin at the time. It's important to note that these actually aren't still around. A lot of the brewers in this particular minute book would have folded over time. Guinness is the big name that still survives from that era. Just a few years after this, Arthur Guinness was also appointed head brewer at Dublin Castle. So if you're familiar with your Irish history, Ireland was still under English rule at that point in time, and the seat of English government in Ireland would have been Dublin Castle. So to be appointed head brewer at somewhere like Dublin Castle, there is literally no higher position in the land.
Just beyond that gate then, as it is now, is the bustling city of Dublin, a city that manages to stitch together a cosmopolitan tourism trade, a global tech economy, and its sought-after and prized provincialism all in one. And it's on this semi-permeable line between the brewery and the city, amongst the manufacturing and supply routes, that Arthur Guinness and his wife Olivia established their residence.
So this building here, just to the left of the front gate, this is Noble and Thomas Street. So this is where Arthur Guinness himself, our founding father, lived between 1759 and 1765. So this is where he lived after he signed that lease with his wife, Olivia. And the first of their 21 children was actually born while they were living there.
So we need to pause there for a moment. Now, I grew up as one of three boys. We had a pretty full house. My parents, well, my mom was one of six. They lived on a farm growing up. That's just being industrious. And my dad, he was one of 11, which is almost inconceivable to me. But Arthur and Olivia Guinness had 21. That's the size of all my aunts, uncles, and cousins from an entire side of my rather large family, all living together under one roof. But at the time, this wasn't entirely unusual. In fact, the expectations for such a large family were, by today's standards, pretty morbid.
Somewhat normal, yeah. I mean, birth rates were so much higher, but also quite scarily from our perspective is infant mortality was very, very high as well. So actually only 10 of those 21 children survived into adulthood. So I think the real hero in this story is Olivia Guinness, Arthur's wife.
That's pretty heartbreaking. As hard as it is to imagine 21 children being born into a single family, the portion of my brain that's needed to process losing half of them during their childhood simply refuses to function. Imagine the fortitude necessary to have that many children, and then to lose 11 of them. That's an inconceivable life. It's a mentality and perspective that our modern emotional and psychological assumptions about the world simply cannot make room for. Remember the movie Saving Private Ryan? The entire plot was based on the absurd idea that three brothers dying in the same war was a sort of incomprehensible tragedy. It was almost hyperbolic. If a family today lost 11 children, it'd be a national tragedy, and we'd be a country in mourning. Instead, this was Ireland in the 18th century, and the Guinnesses were busy trying to get on with building a family and a business.
So Olivia was a very great woman who spent nearly 16 years of her life pregnant. A lot of them would have been lost in childbirth itself. But I think a big problem in Dublin around that time was infectious diseases. Diseases that are easily curable nowadays, such as tuberculosis, cholera, scarlatina, those kind of diseases now that we're immunized against when we're children.
And let me qualify this by saying that considering all of this, it's impossible for me to say the next part with an appropriate emotional tenor, considering the near constant specter of death that must have hung over the family. But for the history of Guinness, the brewery, it was basically a survivor story.
But one of the ones that did survive, his name was also Arthur Guinness, and we know him as Arthur II. He became the head of the brewery after the original Arthur. And interestingly, from our perspective, one of his major achievements was laying down the recipe for an extra stout in 1821, Guinness Extra Stout. His father, Arthur, had begun the process of exploration. He actually started brewing an ale in 1759. And by the 1770s, he'd started brewing a darker type of beer called porter. This was a beer that originated in London, and Arthur Guinness saw an opportunity to start brewing it for himself. So by 1799, he'd stopped brewing ale altogether and concentrated on porter. And then under his successors, the first of which was Arthur II, a stouter type of porter begins to be brewed. And by a stouter type of porter, I mean a stronger type of porter. Eventually, this became known as just stout in its own right. So extra stout was the definitive form of that particular variant for Guinness.
There are many ghosts at St. James Gate, both of the corporal variety and those of breweries and distilleries past. And this is when one starts to realize the historic density of this area. While it may be largely defined by its most successful survivor, Guinness, the industrial area was and still is home to some of Ireland's most important brands.
Even in this area alone, we have many kind of ghost breweries. So everybody knows Guinness, but some of the names that you may not be familiar with are, you know, Miller's Brewery, which were a neighbour. You had a Phoenix brewery across the street. You had another brewery called Mander's Brewery, and also many distilleries. So just across the street from us here, you have an old windmill, which was the remnant of the Rose Distillery. And we just revived that name ourselves actually recently with a new Roe & Co. whiskey. And some of the other names you may be familiar with are Powers Whiskey, also Jemson. They also come from this area ultimately. It was a working class district. We're in the district called Liberties. So you had a lot of people, a ready workforce for those kind of industries. And you also had an abundant supply of water because we're right beside what was the end of the city watercourse and the city basin. And that's where a lot of the brewers and distillers were able to tap a water supply, which is so crucial to brewing and distilling. I think also the fact that we're on the edge of the city where a lot of raw materials were coming in from the countryside, such as barley, which was crucial for obviously the brewing and distilling process.
In less industrial terms, this brewing and distilling district is like the left bank of the Seine when Hemingway and Gertrude Stein and Fitzgerald and the likes all cozied up together in Paris. Or Berry Gordy setting up shop in his Hitsville studio in Detroit. When something like this sort of spontaneously generates, it creates a sort of cultural gravity. And it's why across the world, then and now, there are brewing districts that seem to have a purpose beyond just simplifying the logistical and real estate needs of the business. That's why Goose Island is now an anchor amongst half a dozen breweries in Chicago. And why Allagash is surrounded by admiring and aspirational peers in Portland, Maine. And it's why breweries continue to open and prosper in San Diego County. This area of Dublin was like the Silicon Prairie of its time, and Guinness was its Texas Instruments. And it became unstoppable.
Just the quality of the beer, good business acumen, a series of strong leaders in charge of the brewery, meant that within about 100 years, Guinness had grown to be not only the largest brewery in Ireland, but actually the largest brewery in the world. And a huge expansion in the export trade meant that, you know, by 1886, Guinness had gained that title of largest brewery in the world. And the other breweries, the other distilleries, just didn't have that same kind of luck.
Whether they were lucky or simply made their own luck, the survival and success of Guinness as both a brewery and a family was a tragic but ultimately prosperous numbers game. Kevin Tullis, an Irishman who wrote the memoir My Father's Wake, How the Irish Teach Us to Live, Love, and Die, saw a profound lesson in his own father's death when he wrote, "To be truly human is to bear the burden of our own mortality and to strive, in grace, to help others carry theirs. Sometimes lightly, sometimes courageously. In communally accepting death into our lives through the Irish wake, we are all able to relearn the first and oldest lessons of humanity. How to be brave in irreversible sorrow. How to reach out to the dying, the dead, and the bereaved. How to go on living no matter how great the rupture or loss. How to face your own." In the following episodes of this series, we're going to look at some of the things that made the brewing of Guinness and its many iterations a sort of bridge between the old world and the new, as it graduated from being Ireland's largest brewery to the world's largest brewery, and how they employ technical innovation to hold the line on what a proper Guinness is supposed to taste like.
And one of the interesting things I find in the archives is, you know, our brewers and our management looking into the impact of the wood on the beer, and especially the bacteria such as lactobacillus, you know, what impact was that having on the flavour? And when we moved away from wooden vessels, they were very, very careful to make sure that the impact that the wood was having on the beer was transferred over to our new vessels.
Until then, aim true, pour liberal, folks. Have a great week.